This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It was a squeaker, but New Hampshire House Speaker Sean Jasper is on track to keep his gavel after winning over his Republican caucus. One thing on the GOP agenda from top down will be tightening election laws. GOP party chairman Jennifer Horne says she won't seek another term at the helm. While New Hampshire's top Democratic Party official Raymond Buckley has his set sight on becoming his party's national chairman. We'll discuss those headlines and other news, like how the Seacoast may prepare for high water and how some area high schools are giving students a reprieve from the hell of the 7:30 first bell. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Good day. Joining us this morning are Casey McDermott, NHPR, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning. Let's start with Speaker Sean Jasper's win this week. Speaker's races always contain a little bit of surprise or two. This one took two ballots within the Republican caucus, but Sean Jasper prevailed 109 to 104 over Bedford Rep. Lori Sanborn. This race started with four candidates, Jasper, Sanborn, Carol McGuire of Epsom, and Frank Saporetto of Derry. But it really turned out being about the two, wasn't it, Casey?
Yeah, so it started out with four people, as you said, Carol McGuire, Frank Saporetto, Lori Sanborn, and Sean Jasper, the incumbent. And Sean Jasper has had kind of a rocky tenure within his own party pretty much since he took the Speaker's gavel a few years ago, and that stemmed from some kind of last-minute maneuvering with him and the Democrats to kind of oust former Speaker Bill O'Brien from taking a second grab at the Speaker's seat a few years ago. So that really kind of set a contentious tone with some members of his own party from the beginning. So as you can imagine, that made things a little bit difficult over the last few years. We had several challengers, as we said, who came forward and tried to challenge him for the speakership. At the last minute, my understanding is that Carol McGuire of Epsom dropped out, told her supporters to unite behind Lori Sanborn. On the first ballot, it was pretty close. I believe it was 106 to Sanborn 102, but they needed 108 votes to prevail. So that went to a second ballot. And at that point, Frank Saporetto, who I think only got three votes on the first ballot, dropped out. And from there, Jasper was able to prevail by a margin of just a few votes.
All right. So, why don't we take a listen to what Speaker Jasper had to say after winning that caucus vote?
You put how I came into office and what we went through. You know, this was somewhat remarkable, the fact that I was able to be renominated after everything that's happened in the last 2 years. So I think the fact that I got a majority of the Republican caucus with so many new people out there who don't know me, that was a big win.
All right. That was House Speaker Sean Jasper after winning his caucus vote and, you know, setting himself up to win the Speaker's gavel again on Organization Day. Now, you know, he mentioned some of the fracture there that took place over how he got elected in the first place. And, you know, that led to, you know, censure by the executive committee of the GOP, dueling caucus offices, ill will. Kevin, is it safe to assume that all that is bygones at this point?
Yeah, certainly Speaker Jasper has a chance of governing, I think, with more harmony than he did the last 2 years. And the principal reason is he has a Republican governor, Chris Sununu, I think, who really wants and needs a united House. I think Chris Sununu's biggest concern with all of this was producing a race such as we had this week. Because it is so close, he's going to have to work hard in the first couple of months of his administration to make sure the House Republicans are all sort of rowing together and not apart. We saw that certainly in the beginning of Jasper's term when he defeated former Speaker Bill O'Brien in that Speaker's race 2 years ago, a lot of his detractors spent, particularly that first year, trying to give him a hard time. And certainly Jasper should get some help from Sununu in trying to maintain some discipline. State Representative Sanborn has made it clear she's not going to bring her debate, the race for Speaker, to the floor of the House. She supports the will of the caucus and is sort of taking a wait-and-see approach with regard to Jasper. I think his biggest challenge right now is basically to try and frame an agenda for next year in particular that conservatives can rally behind.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Speaker Jasper said about some of the things he hopes to address out of the gate here.
We had the issue of constitutional carry, which we passed twice. We'd like to get that through. We have a lot of work to do in the area of domicile and our voting issues. You know, we've got drive-by voting in New Hampshire. We couldn't make progress there.
Okay, that was Speaker Sean Jasper after being the choice of the caucus. Now, Dean, you've heard him mention election law, guns. Those are obviously issues where, with a Republican legislature and a Republican in the corner office, on paper, the signals are there that there's going to be agreement on some of those things. But, you know, the details can be trickier than the big picture. These are also things that Chris Sununu has mentioned. What else do you see as areas where they're going to work?
Yeah, well, I think Kevin's right. What a difference having a Republican governor will make. I think there's clearly this kind of, pent-up energy among particularly conservatives in the House caucus to move on things like voter ID, constitutional or concealed carry, depending on your perspective, and a number of other issues as well. And here is a Speaker of the House who, undercut his own caucus 2 years ago by partnering with Democrats to edge out Bill O'Brien, and now he managed to win again in his own right, even though it was only a 5-vote margin. We've talked about the fracture in the Republican Party here in the state for the last 2 years, particularly that first year, as Kevin mentioned. I think now being in the majority, even though it's not a huge Republican majority in the House, it's about 52 seats, something like that. I think there's an opportunity for Republicans to move forward on some of these issues. And if they move early on, for example, tightening voter laws or concealed carry, constitutional carry, I think that'll engender some goodwill toward Jasper from conservatives. And, the pushback to him all along from people like Sanborn and McGuire, they're the conservatives from the House Republican Alliance, has been over this issue of, compromising with Democrats. He got a lot of criticism on Medicaid expansion. I think it's just, it's a different ballgame. When you think about the number of issues over the past number of years in which a Democratic governor, which we've had essentially for most of the last 20 years, has been able to veto, it's going to feel different, I think. And I think that gives Jasper a little bit of breathing room to work with conservatives in the caucus.
Well, one thing that struck me that didn't come up publicly terribly much that I anticipated might have was this letter that Jasper had written to Republicans as they were preparing to revise the party's platform, where he essentially advised on the grounds of pragmatism is what he said, but stripping out all sorts of specific language regarding right to work and merit pay. He didn't want that in the platform. He didn't want a provision calling for a limitation of state spending to inflation and population growth. He didn't want opposition to expanded gambling in there. He wanted references to repealing Obamacare out of the platform. He also wanted to ditch language about overturning the Claremont School funding ruling and ascertaining rights for what the platform referred to as the preborn. He wanted the platform to be silent on marriage, which right now defines it as the legal and sacred union of one man and one woman. We could go on, but that's kind of a full gamut of things that are important
right
to conservatives.
Yeah. And you mentioned right to work. That may be another issue. Chris Sununu, I think, has mentioned that as something he supports. We may see that again. Sure, those are precisely the kinds of issues that caused him headaches with conservatives in the party, but it's a different context now that they're going to have a majority and a Republican governor. He may not have the same kind of pressure to think so pragmatically. Now, that may just be how he is as a legislator, but it's just different when you're dealing with a Democratic governor.
Well, one thing that's also been different, and, Casey, you've spent a lot of time with Governor-elect Sununu during the campaign, is the way in which some of his priorities are being articulated in this sort of moment of transition. We're hearing a lot about things that he didn't really talk about much when he was campaigning.
Yeah, it was a little surprising to me, just following along ahead of the speaker vote, where he identified, I think, voting reform, electoral reform, and right-to-work legislation as two of his top legislative priorities moving forward when he was addressing the caucus there. Those are things that did not come up terribly frequently on the campaign trail. We heard him talk a little bit about his desire to see changes in the state's voting rules, particularly around same-day registration and the residency requirements. That came up kind of, offhandedly during an interview at the end of the campaign, and then since developed into a kind of a more concrete policy discussion when he was asked kind of what solutions he would propose to fix the issue of kind of drive-by voting as he saw it. Right to work didn't come up a lot during the campaign.
There was something he mentioned
something,
to the caucus when he addressed them the other day, which I thought was interesting because Sean Jasper has been, to the extent that, you know, he's liked to say that the agenda comes from the caucus up, but right to work is an issue, Kevin, where he's been pretty outspoken that he doesn't think it's he doesn't think it's worth pursuing.
Yeah. One of the problems Speaker Jasper has with right to work essentially is the support which helped him become Speaker 2 years ago. Many of the people who supported him, Republicans who basically went with Democrats in order to elect Jasper Speaker, many of them opposed right to work. They were kind of pro-labor Republicans in that caucus. So that's one of the reasons why, while Jasper supports right to work, he felt it shouldn't be a litmus test issue in the party. What we're seeing really from Sununu is lessons from the campaign. I think one of the lessons we take from what happened in that race for governor essentially was
he almost lost in the primary.
he almost lost the primary. He had a lot of difficulty kind of coalescing the Republican Party together after that close primary. And I think if we look at what happened in the election, essentially a couple of things. Sununu, I think, profited from staying with Trump. At the end of the day, people who voted for Trump ended up voting for Sununu. I think that was good for him in this race for governor. And I think because I think even polling up to a couple of weeks before the election essentially was showing that was Sununu's problem, was that only about 75-78% of Republicans were saying they were going to vote for him. And it was kind of the hangover from that primary. And the fact that during the campaign, he took a lot of positions that a doctrinaire conservative Republican might not take, whether it's decriminalizing marijuana or being open to casino gambling in the future. These are things you usually don't hear a conservative Republican talk about.
There are risks for Chris Sununu because if you buy into the idea that this election in part was about economic concerns and the not everyone being brought along in the recovery from the Great Recession, and Sununu ran on some of these populist economic issues just like Donald Trump did. He talked about business conditions in New Hampshire, regulation, et cetera. If you set that up, kind of economic agenda up, but then your first moves as governor are to focus on things like voting regulations, gun control, kind of the conservative ideological agenda rather than economic policy, you know, he could get sidetracked and it could hurt him. So he has to be careful to not lose sight of kind of the bigger issue, which was that economic concerns were driving a lot of what we saw across the country.
I do think it is worth noting that Right to Work was, if anyone took the time to read his economic plan, it was in there as one of the kind of points that he identified, just saying that businesses across the country are moving to Right to Work states. Now, the actual numbers on those are kind of, you know, mixed in terms of whether the data bears that out. But Chris Sununu did identify this, at least on paper, as something that was a priority for him. Now, having followed him around on the campaign trail, again, I didn't hear him talk about this a lot or just talk about how he would want to achieve this. So I think it's going to be interesting to see kind of the details of how that kind of legislation shapes up.
Well, one thing he did say from the beginning, he did say after he won that narrow primary over Frank Edelblue, one of the things he said is, like, I've been running a general election strategy from the beginning, and as he transitions to becoming governor, I guess I'm curious to watch whether or not he's running a you know, what sort of plan he's running as a governor? Does he feel like he needs to start out running kind of a primary style campaign and appealing to the base of his party, or does he, you know, sort of reach more broadly to the policies that might have a broader spectrum of support?
Well, you might risk alienating. You know, it's one thing to kind of try to please your caucus and please your, you know, the lawmakers within your own party, but then you also have to think there's another election in 2 years, and if you go, you know, maybe too far to the right, you would risk alienating voters who maybe like elected you thinking that you were going to be a more moderate kind of governor with broader kind of political appeal.
One of the things obviously Sununu's got to worry about that, you know, more than 45 governors don't have to worry about is a 2-year term. He's already in re-election mode, right? So he's already got to be thinking about how do I frame this agenda that'll be appealing in a couple of years. Right to work has a lot of appeal for someone like Sununu for a couple of reasons. One, free market conservatives really like this. New Hampshire would be the only state in the Northeast to have right to work if it adopts it. It would nationally kind of put Sununu on the map as a governor who's innovative, a conservative who gets things done. The other thing is we saw in this race for governor, Sununu had a lot of problems raising money and was badly outspent by the Democrat nominee, Colin Van Osten. And I think that's something he needs to worry about in 2018, because there's not going to be a lot of outside money coming into the state without a presidential election and without a U.S. Senate fight. So right to work is another issue on which nationally you can raise money off of. A lot of conservatives are very fond of this, and this could help him build his fundraising base, which he really needs to do.
And, you know, Medicaid is going to be a big one for it was a mark against Sean Jasper in the eyes of conservatives in his caucus. You know, Chris Sununu said he's going to take a wait and see approach, try to leverage, what New Hampshire can get in order to sort of keep the program if it works, but hold that over the federal government. We don't really know exactly how the Trump administration's CMS office is going to work. But Kevin, would you anticipate that this would be something that Sununu would want to get out ahead of and anticipate his policies in his budget, or let this sit for a while?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's such an unknown for him. I think he may well assume the status quo operates as he puts his budget together and see what happens. Because frankly, at the end of the day, I think Medicaid expansion and the way we have it here could well change dramatically under this administration. I mean, if this president-elect Donald Trump works with the Republican Congress, you know, headed by Speaker Paul Ryan, he certainly wants to take Medicaid and turn it into a block grant and basically send the money back to states and say to the states, you design the Medicaid program you want to have. And in which case, Medicaid benefits in New Hampshire could look a lot different than they look right now.
Yeah, and, you know, Jasper mentioned himself that we've got 50,000 plus people on this in New Hampshire. However you configure it, during an election year, do you necessarily want to be sunsetting their insurance coverage and their health care? So I think you're right. I think there's a fair bit of uncertainty. We need to see what the Trump administration is going to do and what the program will look like going forward. But I think it's certainly something that Sununu is going to have to grapple with, whether it's simply additional extensions or some sort of reconfiguring. You know, there's a significant number of people on the program, and they'll have to figure out some way going forward to keep them, give them continued access to health care.
All right, coming up more in the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup in just a minute from NHPR. Do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this morning by Casey McDermott of NHPR, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Let's stick with the governor-elect for a minute. He's fleshing out his transition team. He now has Bill Ardinger, lawyer at Rath, Young & Pignatelli, tax expert, for a long time ago, a House member himself as a young man. Do you think that his inclusion on the team signals that we're going to see tax changes and possibly cuts in Chris Sununu's budget, Kevin? Or is Ardinger simply a plausible guy with ability who you might tack onto a transition team?
Yeah, I think Ardinger is certainly a really good pick for Sununu. One of the things he is not is sort of a member of the kind of Sununu family orbit. So many of the people that Sununu surrounded himself with early on in this administration, which you would expect, were people who were friendly with the Sununu family, who worked for Sununu's either in government or not in government. Bill Ardinger doesn't fit that category. I think he is somebody who has a lot of depth and knowledge about both the state and federal tax structure. He's testified in Congress a lot as well. Very smart guy. This state budget certainly is going to be a challenge to put together. And having Charlie Arlinghouse there certainly should help him do it. And I think Bill Ardinger will help as well, because even though state revenues did very well, we ended up with a surplus. Most of that money got put into the rainy day fund. So actually, there's not a lot of cash just lying around for this new governor to spend.
Another thing that Bill Ardinger was involved, I mean, he was named to Craig Benson's transition team, and he was involved in the drafting of at least one of Governor Lynch's failed school funding amendments that wanted to give lawmakers a freer hand to target aid. You know, one thing Chris Sununu did talk about was revisiting Claremont with an amendment. That's obviously been a very tough sell in the legislature, regardless of who's in the corner office. Do you think we're going to see action on that front, Kevin? You've been watching this a very long time, obviously.
Yeah, that's a really difficult issue to navigate, as you point out. Particularly in the New Hampshire House, you need 60% support to amend the Constitution in the House and the Senate. But certainly, Sununu philosophically thinks the legislature should be calling the shots and not the courts.
I mean, I guess it's interesting. So, well, to the extent that Sununu's campaign had like an overarching theme, it seemed to be, I'm going to come in and refresh, retool the so-called New Hampshire advantage. And, you could see if he could get right to work through potentially, if he could make some alteration to the business taxes, school funding amendment. He's planning to do this business tour. This is, as you point out, the revenues have been pretty good in the budget, but, it's not like there's a bottomless pit of money to spend. And, if he's going to sell himself, it's going to be on these sorts of things, it strikes me, Dean. Mm-hmm.
That's right, and that's what I was sort of referring to earlier when I said that, Sununu kind of laid out the sort of revamping of the or refreshing of the New Hampshire advantage as part of his economic message during the campaign, and now that he have the sort of energy in the Republican caucus, he has to sort of balance moving on some of these other issues like voting rules and concealed carry, et cetera. So we'll see. There'll probably be some look at business taxes. We're already kind of in the midst of one set of or we're about to probably have the second phase of some Republican tax cuts from when Hassan vetoed the budget. And so we'll see. I think it's going to take a little bit of time. The education issue is just such a complicated issue. We've seen governors just not have a lot of success on that for a long time. So, we'll see. But I do think Sununu has an opportunity to kind of move on some of this economic agenda if that's what he really wants to do, given that he's got a Republican Congress, Republican legislature.
I do think, too, though, it's one thing for him to kind of move in that direction. And then the next question is, does that actually work? And is that actually what is going to kind of revitalize the state's economy? Because if you look at kind of where his, public priorities, at least on the stump, are bringing more more business into the state, revitalizing businesses. That's one thing. But when you talk to like economic analysts here, or policy analysts, a lot of what you hear is that there is plenty of business, there are plenty of jobs here, but they're having trouble finding people to fill them. So that's kind of another piece of the puzzle in terms of kind of bringing back the New Hampshire advantage, is kind of addressing that other piece of the equation when it comes to the workforce.
I mean, for the New Hampshire advantage often is, as has been said, of domicile for voting, a state of mind. And certainly Chris Sununu is going to be out to sort of boost the notion that a new state of mind is afoot. And, you know, the budget will be his first major policy statement. And, you know, as people, sagely or not, remind me every time I tune into coverage of Trump's transition effort, you know, personnel is policy, perhaps. But, you know, after the inauguration's done, Chris Sununu will have a few jobs to pick pretty much straight out of the gate. Top state post, Casey, won't he?
Yeah. So there are a number of things that are going to be kind of opening up or, you know, up for him to fill in the next year or so. The AG is a big one. Attorney General Joe Foster's term is going to be up early next year. There's also several seats on the State Board of Education, the Commissioner of the Department of Education, a few slots on the New Hampshire Supreme Court, the Department of Environmental Services. So this is kind of running the whole, you know, whole range of areas of state policy. And while, you know, the level of influence that each of those people can actually exert over state policy varies depending on the post, in terms of kind of directly enacting rules or things like that, you know, these are nonetheless kind of, as you said, symbolic positions. So I think paying attention to kind of the type of people that they put in there, the principles that they bring to those positions is going to be something to watch over the next several months.
And having four Republicans on the Executive Council may be handy in this moment for him as well. We have an email in from Pamela who says, please explain what right to work means for companies and workers. Tags and titles don't tell voters why these things should matter to them. Thank you, Pam. Point well taken. Right to work is legislation that would aim to make it impossible for unions to collect fees from workers that are not true, not full membership fees, but the fees involved with representing them in labor negotiations. Although right to work can come in several flavors, but that's what that means.
Yeah, you can't make paying of fees or membership dues a requirement for employment, essentially.
All right, thank you for the email. And why don't we go to the phones? Dave is on the line from Tilton. Good morning, Dave.
Well, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I got a big question, kind of got a lot of aspects to it. Other than L.A. and New York, I think the flavor for most of the American people was we reject the Democratic ideals and goals of the last 8 years, and they're not in touch with the common man. And by electing Nancy Pelosi again, the same old grind, and our two congressmen voted for her, how would the Democrats and the leadership going to reach out to the common man and the common woman and the common person who goes to work every day and struggles?
All right. Thank you, Dave. I think it's a good question. That was in some ways, that was the rationale for the challenger to Nancy Pelosi, Representative Tim Ryan, who you know, said that Nancy Pelosi was ill-equipped to do that. Obviously, Nancy Pelosi is a sort of mixed bag, polarizing figure. Republicans were in some ways pleased she was reelected, but she's a good fundraiser and obviously has a loyalty of the caucus team.
Yeah, she's known as a prolific fundraiser. You know, there is some concern. She's been in the leadership a long time, as has the rest of her team, Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn. All in their 70s, you know, sort of the median age of the leadership in the Democratic Party in Congress is somewhere in their early 70s, early mid 70s. So there was a sort of push to kind of create room for younger members of Congress. The argument has been that Democrats have not been carefully developing their bench, so to speak, for the future. And you mentioned Congressman Ryan, who got, I think, like 63 votes, something about a third of the caucus, which means two thirds still voted for her. And, you know, it's a legitimate question about what is going to be kind of the change in focus or policy or approach to try to reconnect with these voters. And, you know, the big missing piece of the puzzle is, you know, who's going to be the next chair of the Democratic National Committee. That will go kind of a long way to helping them decide strategy. But, you know, there is some legitimate concern that she's been at this a long time. She kind of has a sort of a locked grip on the leadership, and she has agreed, though, to create some I believe, some additional positions to get some of the younger members of the Democratic caucus into leadership as kind of a compromise. And we'll see how that goes.
All right, Dean, we're going to get to the future of the Democratic National Commission and Committee in a minute. But first, I want to talk about, you know, transitions going on at the State House. It's also going on right now within the State Republican Party. Two-term chair Jennifer Horne formalized yesterday that she would not be seeking another term at the state party meeting in January. You know, Kevin, she came in at a tough time. Fractious party is leaving with a Republican in the corner office for the first time in 12 years. Good results at the state level, mixed bag at the federal level.
Yeah, certainly not leaving in an exceptionally weak position. The party, I think the big challenge for the New Hampshire Republican Party is to really build a better fundraising base than they have right now. That's been something that Chairman Horne really didn't succeed in doing. And frankly, she wasn't the first chairman to fail at that. You know, it's been very hard for Republicans here in this state that lead the party to build a donor base within this party, a consistent donor base that will support it. Republican activists historically, those who give money tend to be more involved in presidential campaigns and helping support candidates for president as they come through here in New Hampshire rather than building the base of the party. The other thing that New Hampshire Republicans don't have that certainly the Democrats have had for a long time is support of the national party, the New Hampshire Democratic Party's financial base. Every year includes a significant amount of support from the national party, whether it's the governors, the Democratic National Committee, the congressional committees. They all sort of chip in to help New Hampshire and have for the past 15 years or so. And that's made it a lot easier for Democrats in this state to financially compete.
Well, another thing that the Republicans don't have that Democrats have in this is a chairman who receives compensation for their work from the party. And obviously, Raymond Buckley was the first Democratic chairman to strike that sort of arrangement. But it seems to have worked swimmingly for both party and Buckley. Jennifer Horne, I thought it was interesting that that's one thing that she said as she leaves, that she hopes that Republicans will, you know, go somewhat that route. And this has been something that has been discussed at, I believe, the last two meetings where it comes up. It's been tabled. And I know talking to people who are, you know, intimately involved in the running of the party, they really see themselves as working at a disadvantage against Democrats. Part of it, the larger funding issues Kevin mentions, but also the fact that, you know, an uncompensated chair. And so, you know, what do you make of that, Dean?
I think it's a legitimate concern. You know, the more resources you have, the more professionalized your staff can be, the greater reach you can have in terms of technology, in terms of grassroots organizing. This has been kind of an ongoing disadvantage, I think, for Republicans. I don't know whether or not it will happen going forward, but it certainly is kind of a noticeable difference between how the two parties function within the state.
Well, why don't we hear from Jennifer Horne? This is what she said yesterday when she had announced that she's not going to be seeking another term.
I'm really proud of what Chris Sununu has accomplished and the fact that we have this Republican governor-elect. Of course, he should have his own team in place. But me deciding not to run has nothing to do with Chris. It's about recognizing for myself that I've reached the end of what I want to be able to accomplish here, and it's time to start and do something new.
All right. That was Jennifer Horne, chairman of the Republican Party in New Hampshire yesterday. And, you know, she said it has nothing to do with Chris. When I spoke with her yesterday, she also assured me that it had nothing to do with Donald Trump. Horne, there was some friction during the campaign with Donald Trump. Some Trump loyalists called for her resignation for statements she made about Donald Trump. She also, you know, got into the jam over Frank Ginta when she wrote a letter saying that essentially she had lost faith in Ginta and that she didn't believe he was being truthful about his campaign's finance violation. That actually prompted the party's vice chair, attorney Brian Gould, to resign. And so Horne, you know, she was in there in a tough spot. And, you know, at least based on the sort of parting statements from people like Governor-elect Sununu, from Kelly Ayotte, who both said that Horne strengthened the party. I think it's fair to say she's leaving the party in a better situation than she
well,
when
she
took over.
She can certainly claim that, you know, and she mentioned several times that, you know, she's leaving with a Republican in the corner office at the State House. But, you know, the Republicans under her leadership have not had a lot of luck with Congress. We got an all-Democratic congressional delegation. They were unable to take out Jean Shaheen. You know, Carol Shea Porter is back. Maggie Hassan, even though it was incredibly close, beat Kelly Ayotte. So, I think the congressional seats and figuring out how to get a handle on those races, I think, will be a challenge for whoever the next chair is. But certainly she can go out saying, you know, we have a state, we have a Republican majority in the state legislature, and now we have, for the first time in many years, a Republican governor. And that's kind of I think she views that as kind of a nice note to go out on.
All right. Tell us what you think. Does leading a political party in this day and age at the state level warrant a salary or a slice of the fundraising, tithing from members, something to keep the wolf from the door? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Casey, no sooner was Jennifer Warren saying, "I'm leaving," than the campaign to be her successor is afoot. And who are the names out there thus far?
Well, right now, I think one of the ones that was floating around to begin with was the current vice chairman, Matt Mayberry, who my understanding is he's relatively well-liked within the party, very genial, kind of a diplomat, reaching out to lots of people and has been kind of, you know, really working hard for the party for a number of years now. Another one that floated just this morning was former state senator Jeanne Forrester, who was also a former Republican candidate for governor, many might remember from this year. So that'll be interesting just to see kind of what she brings to the table, what kind of strategies she's
proposing.
Per
her press release, she's saying she'll make New Hampshire red again. So,
we also heard Make New Hampshire Great Again at the speaker battle earlier today. So that's providing plenty of fodder for kind of Granite State Republicans here as well as Donald Trump. But I would not be surprised if we see a number of other names kind of emerge over the next few weeks.
Yeah, certainly at the end of the day, this is probably going to be Sununu's pick to make. The Republican State Committee will choose the chairman, but Sununu will anoint Jennifer Horne's successor. There's no doubt in my mind that's probably going to happen. Your question is, who is that going to be? We're certainly hearing that Sununu's kind of been searching for the right candidate. I think he's looking, like I was talking about earlier, he's looking for someone who can raise money better than Jennifer Horne the last couple of chairs were able to do. I mean, the last time Republicans really had a financial horsepower was when John H. Sununu, the former governor of White House chief of staff, was chairman of the party. He could really make the rain come in New Hampshire financially for the party, and they've missed that badly. The other thing I think Sununu wants in the next chairman is somebody who has a relationship with Donald Trump, someone who can be a good emissary to the Trump administration at that position. So that's who essentially Sununu is looking for.
That's an interesting sort of skill set, given Trump's local supporters. There are not a lot of people that leap to mind that meet those two.
They're not. And as you look at a lot of the candidates and names that are being kicked around right now, none of them really fit that bill. I think Sununu will keep searching. He has a number of weeks to do that.
All right, coming up, more Grant State headlines on our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHBR. Please join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, and Casey McDermott, NHPR. Now, we've referred to him in the context of party chairman. Let's talk about Ray Buckley. He's been the longtime chairman of New Hampshire's Democratic Party, and he's looking to make the leap to lead the Democratic National Commission. Dean, what do you make of that?
We've kind of been hearing that he might do this for a while now. In some respects, he's viewed as kind of a consummate insider in the party. He was elected here in New Hampshire in 2007, professionalized the job, as you mentioned. He's a vice chair of the National Party. He's the chair of the chair of the Association of all the state Democratic chairs. So he's a chair of chairs. So he's really well connected. Not as well known nationally. It really kind of depends on the direction in which the National Party wants to go. He has suggested maybe even a kind of a bifurcated approach in which someone like him would do kind of grassroots work at the state levels. If you look at where the state governorships and state legislatures are now in the country, Democrats have really taken a hit. They've lost a lot of governorships over the last 8 years. They've lost a lot of state legislatures. Buckley has said he wants to kind of renew the focus on that in the grassroots, and then you could perhaps have somebody else who has more national visibility to be kind of the sort of the spokesperson for the party on cable news, et cetera. It's a very fluid race right now. Keith Ellison, a member of Congress, first Muslim member of Congress from Minnesota, is in the running. Howard Dean wants to come back. He's known for the famous 50-state strategy. People are mentioning South Carolina Party Chair Jamie Harrison, and there are others as well. This will be decided in late February. There are, I think, 447 people who will be voting on this. So he's got a little bit of time to sort of campaign for the job. But it's not clear yet what's going to happen. But a lot of it really kind of depends on where the party wants to go. And I think that very basic question, I think, is being debated right now among party regulars.
Well, it's important to recognize who will be voting. It is people who are members of the DNC, and certainly while Raymond Buckley isn't as well known as some of the other names being tossed around, he's certainly well known to the people who vote.
Sure.
And in the absence of a Democrat in the Oval Office who would have the power to more or less pick somebody to do this job, this might be a moment where, you know, somebody kind of not inside the Beltway and with a lower name recognition could go someplace.
And the argument he's going to make is that New Hampshire has been kind of one of the few bright spots for Democrats, certainly in terms of, you know, congressional elections and statewide performance, by presidential candidates for Democrats. So he could make that argument, and we'll kind of see kind of how the debate shapes up. I saw one count whereby, you know, he sort of plugged in with at least half of those 447 people because he's the chair of chairs and he works with a lot of these folks regularly. But there is kind of the issue of who would be, you know, was he sort of the right kind of spokesperson nationally for the party, as opposed to kind of his ability to kind of work the grassroots. And with that, I think that question is still out.
I mean, I reported a story on Buckley's chances earlier this week, and I talked to a couple of delegates from out of state. I talked to a woman in California who said, you know, she represents the Western Caucus of the DNC. I think it was 16 states. And she basically said, you know, when I ring the alarm, he's there. She said, you know, some of these other names, she's like, I certainly haven't heard of them. He's been in touch. He's been working it. So it will be interesting to see on that level. And certainly, like, you know, you mentioned Keith Ellison. He has the support of a lot of some of the big names in the party on Capitol Hill. But the question about, again, it sort of almost gets back to the question about the local Republican committee. Do you want somebody doing this full time, or do you want somebody with a split responsibility? And we kind of saw what happened with Debbie Wasserman Schultz on that front, didn't we, Casey?
We did. And I think that, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see, like you said, kind of how that shakes out. And I think that Buckley does kind of stand a good chance making the argument that, listen, I really built up the party here. We have a well-oiled machine in terms of getting out the grassroots. And what you're hearing, at least what I'm seeing a lot of the national conversation around kind of the Democrats' path forward, a big component of that is the need to focus on local races, to focus on state races. Now, you know, the Democrats did fare better at the top of the ticket this year, so that might be kind of a dent against Buckley's argument in terms of being able to build up the party at the local level. But they didn't, you know, they didn't lose a bunch of seats in the House.
I mean, they
held on to
they
held on to the same majority in the Senate and are, you know, have always been focused on kind of recruiting and lining up people for the next races down the road. So I could see where Buckley, as you guys said, has a plausible argument to make that New Hampshire has been kind of a firewall this year and in past years for the Democrats.
And, you know, if Democrats ever want to win back the House of Representatives, they need to make a dent in state legislatures in advance of the 2020 census, because that's when redistricting is going to occur. And until they do that, they're going to just be at this big disadvantage. And I think Buckley certainly is somebody who's kind of aware of that and can kind of move on that. The big question, again, is this issue of who is sort of the representative of the party. And, you know, maybe he could suggest something where he does the grassroots and someone like Ellison is kind of the spokesperson nationally. We don't know. But that, I mean, he's sort of suggesting maybe that's sort of one possibility.
He obviously would, what are his strengths? Certainly, this would be a milestone if he were to become chairman. He'd be the first openly gay chairman of a national party in American history. He was the first state party chair in U.S. history who was openly gay. He was the first person elected to the party leadership when he was made a vice chairman almost 8 years ago, who is openly gay. So he certainly has that going for him. What he doesn't have going for him really is his address. I mean, coming from New Hampshire, for someone to run for the national party race is a hard slog. It really is, because in these national party conclaves, you have a lot of members who think New Hampshire already has too much political influence. I mean, ask Steve Merrill about this. When he, Josh, you'll remember when he was leaving as governor and retired, he decided, I think I'll become Republican national chairman. A lot of the talking heads nationally said he'd be great. He's good on television. He's well-spoken. But he ran into a buzzsaw in the Republican National Committee. Unlike Ray Buckley, he was not a creature of that committee. He had not been a chairman. He had not really been active in the GOP politics. And so, despite a lot of support he had nationally among some major figures, he wasn't able to put it together.
Yes, it will be. It will be interesting, and we will see. I mean, one thing that is interesting is that you hear no talk about Democrats here looking to, you know, if to change horses. I mean, he can float his name, and right. You know, he's not going anywhere.
No.
And so that we will see how that goes. And again, that vote is going to be at the end of February in Atlanta. It'll be up to the party. Do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. I want to turn to a big bill that will clear the House of Representatives in Washington, the so-called 21st Century Cures Act, which may have the net effect of freeing up a lot of money that could, piece of it could end up here in New Hampshire to deal with the opioid crisis. Casey, they're talking about $1 billion over 2 years. What's your understanding of how the money would be parceled out?
My understanding is that it will go to states based on the per capita number of opioid deaths, which, you know, if you're looking at just kind of raw numbers, New Hampshire would stand to get less money. But because you're talking per capita, you know, the proportion of deaths relative to the overall population, New Hampshire does have one of the highest rates.
I think we're third.
Yeah, in the nation. So that could, you know, it's kind of a good news, bad news situation in that, you know, obviously it's not a good thing that we have so many deaths, but that does perhaps position us to pick up more resources to try to prevent those and deal with the issue in the future. So this is, you know, it's still kind of, you know, working out my understanding in terms of kind of the actual dollar amount that we're going to get from this. But I think, like I said, that's we're positioned to get a fair chunk of that money because of the rate that we have.
Well, in the bill, and assuming the bill remains the same, President Obama said who will sign it. It, you know, is still going to be considered by the Senate. It cleared the House easily. Both of our members of Congress voted for it. You know, Dean, this bill has been controversial, though, to the degree to which you know, lobbyists have been involved. It doesn't just deal with opioid funding. It deals with FDA changes and would earmark money for medical research. You know, apparently 1,455 lobbyists worked on this bill on behalf of 400 different healthcare companies.
A lot of healthcare and pharma involved. Yeah.
Yes, and you know, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, for instance, has said that she's not going to support this because she believes, despite her desire to get funding out on the opioid front, that the trade-off is too much.
Yeah, it's a tough position to be in for any member of Congress. Certainly, you know, given how serious the crisis has been here in New Hampshire, I think our, you know, members of Congress want to, you know, bring home as much money as possible in order to help fight this. And, you know, that's the sort of the devil's always in the details with these pieces of legislation. You know, it does still have to go through the Senate. You know, we'll see if it's changed in any significant way. But, you know, I think that it while, you know, that may be a potential concern, I think that there is a kind of a premium put on getting this aid to the states as quickly as possible to deal with the crisis. But, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that there are these kinds of trade-offs in a piece of congressional legislation.
And why don't we hear what Second District Congresswoman Annie Custer said about this bill. She thinks it's good as is.
And the number we're looking at right now is $1 billion in funding for heroin treatment, recovery, and law enforcement. It would be money that would go to the states, and the states would decide, knowing their own community, what are the best projects that are up and ready to run.
Okay, that was Second District Congresswoman Annie Custer talking about this 21st Century Cures Act and the possibility of more money to boost programs to address opioid abuse. You know, when she was interviewed on our air, she was asked about, did she share any of Senator Warren's concerns about the FDA approval process? And, you know, she said essentially no, she didn't. You know, Custer did do some lobbying for the drug industry before, and she said that, you know, as somebody who she referenced her mother who had Alzheimer's, and that she believed that the speeding of the process would simply create more opportunities for people to receive treatment in conditions like that. What do you make of that, Kevin?
Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders is another one who said, I don't like this bill, and I'm not going to vote for it. I talked with Senator Shaheen earlier this week. The Senate Democrats caucused about this bill on Wednesday, and this issue came up. She feels fairly confident that only a limited number of Democratic senators are going to be voting off this. This is what we see in, you know, lame duck sessions of Congress quite often, right, is that after an election, certainly exiting members of Congress want to have something to accomplish. Also, people who are have political influence after an election may not have it in January, you know. So Democrats, congressional Democrats who have a lot of power, the Democrat president in the White House, aren't going to have that kind of clout after January. So you often kind of see these.
Sweetening the deal with the money for the funding was saying that's more politically doable after the election than
right.
before.
Right. And what they did with this bill essentially was just to pile one kind of goody after another onto it. That's why you had so many lobbyists on this bill. So, Vice President Joe Biden has his cancer initiative that he's worked on for a couple of years. They put almost $10 billion into this bill for fighting cancer to get the administration support as well. And Senator Shaheen essentially said, you know, this is not the bill I would have written in order to get the opioid epidemic taken care of and dealt with. As we recall, for over a year now, she tried to get emergency funding passed through the Senate, tried to get it onto the so-called CARA bill, the legislation that outgoing Senator Kelly Ayotte had worked on a lot and was unable to get Republicans to support it. She said, this is really the only vehicle we're going to get this done on, and we need to get money now, not a year and a half from now.
Well, you know, one person we haven't talked about today is Senator Ayotte. And, you know, I've been sort of keeping my ear to the ground and to the sky, trying to determine what her next move might be, and not hearing much. Any of you?
No. You know, we had that initial kind of sort of, speculation about her, you know, maybe getting something from the Trump administration, although people were very skeptical given her relationship with him. And as it turns out, he said it's not going to happen. And that's pretty much been kind of the last we've heard. I mean, we are going into the holidays and, you know, she's got some time and, you know, we'll see. But I expect she'll have some opportunities out there.
Yeah, I think for Kelly Ayotte, what she needs to really take a look at is, in terms of her future, is a couple of things. One, does she take a position or a role that would preclude her from running for elective office in the future should she want to? The second really is kind of the lifestyle change that anybody losing a congressional seat has to consider, which is her best employment opportunities, frankly, lie in Washington. And she has very young children. So does she want to uproot the family and move them from New Hampshire to Washington in order to get what would certainly be a well-paying job, whether it be with a defense contractor or a lawyer lobbying firm. She's a former state prosecutor. She certainly has a lot of skills. But those are some of the considerations she needs to make.
I mean, it's true. I mean, once you make that step in one direction, the ship may have sailed if you want to get back into public life.
Right, right. And you rarely see these folks, for example, who decide to become lawyers/lobbyists on Capitol Hill ever return to elective politics.
Given how much money they make as quickly as they do once they get into the private sector, it makes her very uncomfortable to segue back into public life.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time. What's everyone going to be focusing on next week? Casey, what are you going to be looking at?
So we mentioned the appointments that Kristi Noem has to fill. I'm going to keep kind of looking at the implications of that, and also trying to take a closer look at what those people are actually going to be deciding. So what that's going to mean in terms of court decisions, other cases that might come before those boards, et cetera, et cetera.
Kevin,
we're looking at this interesting development that is in the news today. On Mount Washington, they're talking about building a restaurant and a hotel. The owners of the Cog Railway want to do that.
Could be windy up there.
Yeah, and historically there have been hotels up there, but as you point out, given the weather, it's been difficult financially to keep them going. And there are certainly environmentalists and hikers that don't really like the prospects of having a big commercial development atop such an iconic place.
Dean, what are you going to be up to?
Yeah, I'm with Casey. I'm going to be watching the governor's transition. And I should mention, I've had people tweeting at me all hour. We talked early in the show about voter regulations, and Republicans view that as a way to guarantee the vote, but Democrats view it as a disenfranchisement. So we'll be discussing that a lot going forward.
We will. Thanks for joining us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.